Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network with your host, Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger. Tommy is in the bunker, and all systems are go. So, as they say in Hollywood, it's on with the show.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network right here in north central Indiana on another snowy morning. We got about 3 inches last night again, and this morning, mostly this morning. So it's going to be, like as Hugo Winterhalter said, it's going to be a white Christmas or a white Valentine's Day or a white Easter. It's probably going to be even a white 4th of July, man. And we are at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And we hang out down here in the Bob Matthews Memorial Bunker. That's right. And it's the 5th of March, Wotan's Day. David Lane's favorite day. Gee, I forgot to mention, yesterday was the anniversary of our Aryan Woodstock that we held in Napa, California back in 1989, and that was the first actual so-called skinhead big concert that had been held up until that point. But we had to go to court to try to get to do it, and then we got rained out, and finally, the judge said we could have a meeting there, but we couldn't play music. We had the FBI take over a house close to where we were having it. We were having it way out in the country in Napa, California. We had sharpshooters on the ridges who actually told me that if we made any false moves, they would have no qualms in shooting us. So if you think you have problems now putting together a concert, you should have been back then. It was really, it was a tough situation, I'll tell you that. There must have been at least a half a dozen sharpshooters. We were way down low in sort of a low ground, and the sharpshooters were up on the ridges riding horses. And then, like I say, the FBI had all their telephoto lenses and everything and all their guns in a house close to where we were having this Woodstock, and the people who owned the house evidently just let them use it, typical white trader types and like that. Anyhow, it was the first, 1989, and then after that we had several concerts around the country. Yeah, so that was the first one, and not a note was played. Well, I hear Carrie the Fairy's blabbing his big mouth off. He was on the radio or TV, I think it was yesterday, and made the ridiculous statement that this isn't the 19th century. We can't do what Putin is doing over there, and we can't do that, you know. In the United States, of course, we never do that. We never invade other countries and shoot the shit out of them, kill hundreds of thousands of people, and so on and so on and so on. We don't do that. We ain't like Putin. Of course, you're not like Putin because Putin's not killing anybody. How about that? And I don't know about these, where all these wannabe National Socialists came from. They've got them right. The Jewish name, Nazi. They've got all these young guys over there wanting to fight, but I'm afraid that's a part of this racial struggle that I don't think is going to go anywhere except get a lot of people hurt. And a lot of these young people don't know anything about real National Socialism or the racial cause. They don't know for sure whether they're Nazis or whether they're nationalists or they're numbskulls. So So, but we're going to get painted with the brush. We're going to get painted with the same brush, so stand by. Well, we're going to go to D.C. and see what D.C. Scouts got to say today. He's got puts on a pretty good program, so let's go there and listen to D.C. Scout.
This is D.C. Scout reporting to you from the armpit of the Empire, Washington, D.C., on January the 25th, 2014. I'm going to play for you now an excerpt of an interview with a retired Navy SEAL commander who is now a state politician out west. He's going to be talking about the Bin Laden raid. Listen up.
And demand answers. Oh yeah, that's part of why Special Operations for America formed, is that I was so enraged watching a commercial by former President Clinton to articulate that Obama's role was not only critical, he took credit for Bin Laden. And yes, I understand he's a commander-in-chief and it was his decision to go. But there was no mention of the troops themselves that performed the task. There was no mention of the previous administration that developed the capability and teed it up for the Obama administration. I respect that he made the call, but I don't accept that it was his call that made it happen. And Special Operations for America grew out of the genesis of that act because I thought they were using the SEAL teams and our military for political ammunition. And fast forward, here's Syria, you know, much the same.
Going back to the Bin Laden raid, if you can share or elaborate on what it is that you believe happened there. We have heard stories that, you know, I think it was 9 times or 10 times Bin Laden was reported dead before the raid. We know that George Bush or Madeleine Albright said, made a remark in 2004 that George Bush was going to use some kind of October surprise by rolling out his corpse, basically. The mysterious way that this raid was conducted, where his body was allegedly dumped in the ocean before it was even announced to the American people what was going on. And then the sickening tragedy of what happened to the SEAL Team 6 members 90-some days after the raid, of a helicopter exploding or being exploded out of the sky.
Yeah, 93 days later, of course, you're familiar with Charles Strange, his son was on Extortion 17. What's your take on the raid to take out Bin Laden? And really, was Barack Hussein Obama actually calling the shots there?
Well, I believe he was calling the shots, but I also believe he was playing cards. and where did that piece of evidence come from? Well, it comes from a person that's not motivated politically to spin it or shape it. It comes from someone who's in a position to know, and the president was playing cards. You know, obviously the SEAL Team 6 incident where, you know, heroes died in the 47. You know, I think it should be investigated and looked at. Certainly, you know, my understanding of it was there was a cross deck of aircraft. The SEALs were doing missions that night, other missions. You know, and all special forces are out there doing multiple missions tonight. And what you often don't hear about is the other guys. You know, what about the 82nd Airborne? What about the regular army? What about a National Guard? I mean, everyone that's in the war zone is putting their life at risk. And I tell you, a lot of times, you know, being a National Guard, running supplies back and forth is far more dangerous than taking the premier assets and going with the best equipment and having all the intelligence necessary. I mean, it's really the guys on the ground going back and forth that statistics will tell you that are hanging it out there the most, and we gotta give every American that's over there our full support. But with the SEAL incident, I think a lot of it has to do with the rules engagement. I mean, when you limit what you can do, and every time you do an operation, the operational security surrounding it goes out to other layers that you don't control, that don't have a top secret security clearance, you're going to have problems. And it is likely that several operations have gone awry because, you know, the enemy has given a heads up. You know, I don't know whether SEAL Team 6 was targeted. I would imagine they would be because of who they are. I think that, you know, the Army counterpart is targeted because of who they are. And whether I agree with it or not, I mean, today, the 9th of September, we probably lost, one or two soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, in action in Afghanistan. I challenge anyone to find it in the papers. It's probably on page, 17. But you lose a SEAL, you lose a U.S. Navy SEAL, that's front page stuff. And the reason is the media has kind of latched onto the SEALs, and there's a perception that the SEALs and the Special Forces guys represent our nation's best. And when we lose our nation's best, that has a strategic value to the enemy. And it has a very sober reminder that we're at war, back home. So
I agree. Plus, I mean, looking at it, and I don't want to even seem remotely disrespectful to the men and any men and women in uniform, but when you're looking at a SEAL team member, you're talking about a tremendous investment in terms of their training and their equipment. It's so when one or more are taken out, it's really a coup for the enemy, a bigger coup. PR.
Well, yeah, it is. As an example, the helicopter that went down, I think that the number of years representative experience that lost for a country was somewhere around 290 years of cumulative experience on that aircraft. And that you can't regenerate that level of experience, overnight. And it was a significant hit. It was a significant hit to our special forces. It was a significant hit to the families. It went all the way down. And you're right. Is it, special forces are a little older. The training is a little longer. I ran SEAL team training at one time, and we figured it out to be, I think, $1.5 million, per individual was the gross investment on it. And then as far as the timeline goes, if a kid says, I want to be a United States Navy SEAL, okay, your odds of making it.
I'm not getting much out of this retired Navy SEAL officer, so I'm going to move on. What I'm going to play next is an interview by these same two interviewers of a father of one of the Navy SEALs that was killed on that helicopter, and also, so far as I know, took part in the assault on bin Laden's compound. Stand by.
Riveting story, and I have to say, Mr. Strange, Charles Strange is, again, a hero of mine. He's got more guts in his... He's got more guts. Him and his wife have more integrity and guts than many, many people I know. 99% of the people I know. He wants answers. They want answers. And I'll tell you something. They deserve answers. Without further ado, here's a gentleman that appeared on Michael Savage, Alex Jones, other National Press Club, other venues. We are so humbled to have with us Mr. Charles Strange. Mr. Strange, are you with us?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Strange, I got to tell you, in going through, I've spent the last year following this. The last year and a half, actually, following the ordeal of SEAL Team 6. What we're going to do is, why don't you just start right from the beginning? Tell us about your son, first of all. Tell us about Michael, tell us about your visit with him when he came home after the bin Laden raid and his birthday, and what transpired there?
The whole team, all 22 of the special op guys, were home in June. That was their leave. And when Michael came home, he came over, and him and his brother and their girlfriends, and we were, you know, talking and everything, and he went up to the bar up the street. He called me up. He's like, come on up, and I'm feeding shots at Jameson's, and I was messing with him, like, yo, I called him a James Bond guy, you know, and I knew he did a lot of secret squirrel stuff, and he grabbed me by the bicep, and he said, Dad, I got a will, and I'm like, left this, this, and this. I said, what's going on? He said, Dad, I'm not effing around. And I said, and Saturday morning we had a big party for him at his friend's house, big pool and all, and me and him took a walk by ourselves, and he grabbed me again, and he started talking about the will. And he wouldn't see, just said, look, Dad, there's a lot going on. Somebody's leaking something. Something's going on with the team. And he did it a third time. Last time I seen him. That hurt, man. That hurts.
Oh, man.
We kissed, and we kissed. We always kissed each other on the cheek and hugged each other no matter where he was, you know, whatever he was doing. I told him that when he was young. And that was the last time I seen him. And then August 6th, the worst day of my life, I found out my son was killed in Afghanistan in the Ward Eye Providence in the Tangine Valley. And then I hear from all the other parents when their sons were home in June, like nine of them changed their will. One dude who lived in Virginia, you know, they all lived in Virginia. They had to be so far from the base, they couldn't be no longer than 20 minutes from the base. The one guy made everybody in his family come down and see him, even his grandmom. He never did that before. Another guy told his family, I don't know if I'm going to make it back from this one. Another guy told his dad, don't drink all the beer. That's what he used to say, don't drink all the beer. Dad, this time, grabs his dad by the shoulders and tells him how much he loves him and thank you for the way you raised me. They all knew. Somebody was leaking something.
First day he left and went back into the line of duty, you knew something was wrong, as you're saying. What did that feel like? What was going through your mind at that time, while he was still alive yet, seeing the things were different?
A lot of prayers, a lot of Our Fathers, and he couldn't really touch base with him. He would shut down. He was, you know, what them guys did, you know. He grew a beard. And Michael's a cryptologist. We didn't know he was that smart. he really took off in the military. They put him right, you know, once he got through boot camp, Pensacola, Florida, and then right to Hawaii with the SEAL team over there, and under the pineapple fields over there. But that's a whole nother story. But he could, they would give him newspapers from New York, Boston, Texas, Chicago, and he could go through our newspapers and see what terrorists were sending here to their jihadis here in this country.
And, oh, really? Okay. So, you know, and I've heard that, Mr. Stranger, where they use the newspapers to communicate certain things, and we have the best of the best, and it makes me proud to know and comfort to know that somebody like your son was in charge, or, you know, handling that on our behalf. Now, that's real safety. That's real security, not security theater. Now, okay, so did he ever mention to you, by the way, his thoughts on the Osama bin Laden raid and about how that whole thing was handled and the exposure that was given to SEAL Team 6 by this?
No. He told, you know, he just shut everything down. When he would go on certain things, he just, Dad, you're not going to hear from me for 2-3 weeks. Everything's off. I love you, Dad, da-da-da-da-da. And
that's the military oath, yeah. You can't talk about that. Yeah, okay.
Now, No, he wasn't related to Joe Biden or Leon Panetta. No.
Well, you know, we're going to be getting into something. And folks, I want to tell you, we've got a lot of listeners all across the world right now, Mr. Strange. I got to tell you, the messages are lighting up, giving you prayers and support, you and your family, and also saying they love your spunk. And we're going to be getting into something, your exchange with Obama Benghazi. I'm sorry.
Well, I wanted to interrupt this a little bit because I'm not too much into this kind of stuff. DC Wolf's got some points to make, and that's fine, but I'm not into this, our wounded warriors and all that kind of crap. You see, these guys, if they were sent out for me, they'd be right on my front steps with a submachine gun, I'll tell you. I just want to let you know that I'm just not into this militarism and this military-industrial complex, and you know that. So when these people and these parents, that most of them were probably encouraging these guys to go to defend your country, so to speak. Right. So I just really can't weep for them. I can't. There was a time when I would have, but not anymore.
Here in a little bit, but before we do that, and I don't necessarily want, because I can't imagine, as a father, I can't imagine the pain and anguish that you felt. I don't want to put you through anything at all, but what happened after August 6th? What happened after August 6th, after you were notified of your son's passing? What did the military do? They invited you to, or they had you come to Dover Air Force Base, or what happened after that?
Well, August 6th and August 7th, you know, they're telling me the helicopter got hit by an RPG, or the helicopter ran into a mountain, or the helicopter ran into, they didn't tell us right away until it came on the news, August 6th, that it was an RPG, they said. And, there was all kinds of different stories, and I know the men that were at home. They were just doing their job.
Okay, so yeah, you actually didn't know what the cause was for a period of time. Now, okay, so at what point? I mean, you were taken when they brought your son back home and the others back home. Was that like days after this happened, or a week, or a month, or
it took a while for them to come back. I mean, it was August 6th and 7th. They kept saying everybody has to be cremated. Everybody has to be cremated. The helicopter blew up in the sky, blew up again, and then when it hit the ground, it blew up again. Three times they said it blew up, so everybody had to be cremated. Which I found out in December when I asked for the autopsy report from Dover. They sent me the autopsy papers and a disc, and my wife, Michael's stepmom, was looking at the disc. I was reading the autopsy. His lungs were intact, his heart's intact, his liver's intact, his spleen's intact. I said, I'm looking, she's on the computer. I said, pretty bad, huh, bad? She goes, well. I said, well. I said, let me see that. Well, I looked at the picture, and there's Michael laying down. He looked like he had a gun in his hand. Well, he did have a gun in his hand. And his one foot, his ankle was banged up, but none of his hair on his, you could see the hair on his arm. Like he looked like he was laying. He looked like he was fighting for his life.
Really? What was he shot? What was the cause of death? What was the ruling on the cause of death, Mr. Strange? Was it trauma or smoke inhalation or?
There was no smoke in the lungs. They tried to tell us it was G-force, but they were only 150 feet to 100 feet in the air.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. They should have severe trauma to the brain and to the body, but...
Okay. But there was nothing visible because what you saw, and correct me if I'm wrong, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, that is Mr. Strange's wife, Mary, in the background, which is Michael's stepmother, and God bless them both. This is so incredible to be talking with them, but you found out all this from a disc that it's my understanding there was a disc that you were given in addition to a binder of papers that were illegible. You couldn't read them, right? Is that so? You
being asked for a copy of the binder from the military, and
they said it was destroyed, right?
Right.
Yeah. Holy cow.
They said they burned it. Admiral Sean Pybus, Commander in Chief of CENTCOM. Sean Pybus. And, he said they burned it. Can't give you another one. A lot of complaints about that. Sorry about that, Mr. Strange. I won't curse, but. And then they gave us the disc, and you couldn't read. There was a 100.
Well, I'm going to skip all over this for DC Scout. And see if we can find something a little bit more pertaining to our situation on here. Why are these people so shocked that the government lies? Why are they so shocked that commanding officers lie and all these questions? Because that's all they do. That's all Washington does is lie. The military-industrial complex and the armed services lie. They want these guys' bodies and they just throw them in there and get them killed, and they don't even want to talk about how they died. So, again, I'm sorry. I just can't well up any tears for this kind of stuff and serving the country and all that kind of crap. I save my tears for our guys in prison and the border and Bob Matthews when he was burnt alive by these same people. Maybe some of them that were in the SEALs were up there too, because we do know that the military was brought out. There was over 500 officers and troops and Navy personnel brought out to get one man. So I'll reserve my tears for Bob Matthews and Dave Lane and all the boys, and we'll go on, skip on, see if we can find something more interesting.
Story goes on, and we get more details that don't fit. But remember what those SEALs were saying to their parents. Somebody is leaking something. That means somebody is setting them up. And then the DOD changed the story several times about how the chopper went down, and then the bodies were cremated, and the records were burned, the folders were burned, and so on. Once again, we see that these troopers are just pawns. They're like Kleenex. Use them and you throw them away. You contrast everything you just heard from the parents of that SEAL. Contrast all of that to what we just heard from that retired Navy commander, SEAL commander. Did you get anything out of him? I didn't. He started stumbling a little bit and he was dancing around. Well, that confirms what I already knew, is that officers, the majority of your officers are part of the controller class. They control you while they're in, and they get out and they move on up into the controller ranks of the bureaucracies and corporations. So you can't trust an officer much, especially one that's on a government pension. I'm going to read you some excerpts from a story on the Roman conquest of Iberia. And this began around 200 BC, before Christ. And it took the Romans 200 years of guerrilla warfare before they finally controlled the entire peninsula. And we're not told much about how tough the Spanish guerrillas were, and the tremendous problems that they gave to the Romans. But I'm going to be reading you some excerpts here. I'm going to be skipping around. Rome's problems in pacifying her northern, eastern, and southern ramparts seem slight when compared to the almost 200 years of guerrilla warfare she encountered in winning control of Spain. At one time occupied by numerous tribes, some indigenous and some of African stock, Spain had been overrun in the early Iron Age by Celtic tribes from Gaul. Bypassing the ferocious Basques in the northwest, The Celts slowly melded with the original Iberians to produce a Celtiberian race of hardy and warlike peoples. Such tribes as the Cantabrians and Asturians in the north and west, the Galicians and Lusitanians in the south, and the Carpetanians, Vetones, and Numantians in the center remained virtually untouched by the coastal colonizing efforts of Phoenicians, Greeks, Carthaginians, and Romans, who impressed themselves on the more sophisticated and generally peaceful coastal tribes. Roman control of Spain stemmed from the Second Punic War, when the Romans landed an army in Spain in order to deprive Hannibal of support from this Carthaginian stronghold. Now, the Punic War refers to the Poni, the P-O-E-N-I. That's what the Romans called the Carthaginians, the Poni. And Punic refers to anything, is an adjective for the Poni. Continuing the text. The effort did not at first prosper. Gnaeus Scipio, who landed with two legions in 218 at Ampurias and was joined a year later by his brother Publius, fought Hasdrubal and the Carthaginians for several years. By 212 BC, they had pushed well south of the Ebro to occupy an advanced base at Saguntum, from where they had won submissions of many of the local tribes. But now disaster struck. Splitting his forces, Publius was attacked by a Celtiberian force under the guerrilla leader Indibilis, who destroyed the Roman army and killed its commander. Gnaeus was betrayed by local tribes, and he and his army were also destroyed. So the Romans are penetrating the interior now, and they're running into the uncivilized interior peoples. By 205 BC, Rome had replaced Carthage as the overlord of civilized or nearer Spain, consisting of the coastal areas of Andalusia, Murcia, and Valencia. Her holdings consisted of little more than a series of ports or coastal enclaves with finger salients pushing inland, an area occupied both by friendly and by enemy tribes and also subject to raids by the fierce inlanders. The Romans ran into trouble almost at once. The major reason was their attitude, which was purely exploitive in the worst sense. The praetors and their legionaries arrived as civilized conquerors of barbarian peoples. Roman arms had theretofore proved victorious over barbarian rabble, and the Roman Senate saw no reason why this would not prove the case in Spain. Arrogance was not the least of Roman problems. As Professor Sutherland has pointed out, the Roman army was virtually devoid of experience in administering colonial provinces when it took over the coastal regions of the Iberian Peninsula. The efficacy of ensuing military governments waxed and waned in proportion to the individual talents of the praetors or governors general, thenceforth sent with bewildering rapidity from Rome. Bouncing ahead. The upshot of the Roman policy was that the coastal tribes that had been friendly to the Phoenician, Greeks, and Carthaginians now rebelled. In 197 BC, the Romans faced a general insurrection in both provinces. In further Spain, this was led by Indibilis, who had defeated Scipio's father and who was finally slain. Appian tells us that, quote, those who were guilty of inciting the revolt were brought to trial and sentenced to death, and their property was confiscated. The tribes that took sides with Indibilis were fined, deprived of their arms, required to give hostages, and placed under stronger garrisons, end quote. But fighting continued in nearer Spain. By 195 BC, the Roman army controlled only two interior strongholds and the port of Empuriae. A relief army under M. Porcius Cato enticed the insurgents into formal battle and defeated them to win formal submission of the provinces. So dissatisfied were the tribes, however, that rumor of Cato's departure prompted them to a new revolt. Cato answered this insurrection promptly and rigorously. After reducing the dissident communities and selling the people en masse into slavery, He ordered every town in the province to tear down its walls and thus make itself defenseless against his arms. Following his return to Rome in 194, however, there was, quote, no cessation of guerrilla warfare with its constant drain upon Roman troops. Livy can write that a new governor had lost nearly half of his army in this manner during his years of office, end quote. Thus began a pattern, a revolt put down, justice done, treaty signed, exploitation continued, another revolt. Under subsequent praetors, the original stipendium gave way to a dual tax on property and persons. Later, provincial quaestors or financial advisors fixed grain prices to tribal disadvantage, while the army frequently levied extraordinary requisitions of grain with inadequate or no compensation. On occasion, certain excesses proved even too much for Rome. In 171, the Roman Senate's investigation of wholesale graft resulted in the exile of two former governors and some long overdue administrative reforms. By and large, however, the blood-sucking policy continued through the decades and even centuries. In New Carthage, today's Cartagena, Polybius discovered 40,000 slaves, probably Iberian, working in the silver mines, which offered a daily yield of 25,000 denarii. A latter-day historian, A. Shulton, concluded that the Iberians were treated little better than cattle. Wholesale exploitation, unjust taxes, and conscriptive levies continued as a matter of course. The Roman Senate, either not realizing that such a policy could only bring formerly dissident tribes together in mutual indignation, or they realized it and did not care. The ancient historian Livy later pointed out that because of the general policy, the Spaniards were for the first time fighting a purely personal war. And what did Sun Tzu say? Did he say, do not enrage the enemy? Continuing. From the beginning, the Spanish experience heavily taxed Roman resources. By 205 BC, casualties in the Punic Wars had wiped out nearly a fourth of the burgess population. And I think that's like the upper middle class or the minor nobility. The traditional source of the legions' very best recruits and suitable replacements to fill the yawning gaps in the ranks were hard to find. Nonetheless, early losses in Spain were extraordinarily heavy. From 206 to 179 BC, over 70,000 legionaries and 80,000 Latin soci, or allies, were drafted to the provinces. The two crises of 195 and 187 accounted for a proportionately large share of these, but each province appears to have received fairly regular reinforcements, varying from a half legion, as happened frequently, up to 8,000 or 10,000 men. This incessant drain being caused by the ever-widening area of warfare and partly by the peculiarly wearing and expensive character of guerrilla tactics. At a time when the Roman army was already spreading thin, the occupation and for the conquest of Spain called for four strong legions. This commitment was the more serious and indeed marks a very significant change in Roman policy because, as the historian Mommsen points out, the old Roman custom of sending troops only where the exigencies of war at the moment required them and of not keeping the men called to serve, except in very serious and important wars, under arms for more than a year, was found incompatible with the retention in turbulent and remote Spanish provinces beyond the sea. It was absolutely impossible to withdraw the troops from these, and very dangerous even to relieve them extensively. The Roman burgesses began to perceive that dominion over a foreign people is an annoyance not only to the vanquished but the victor, and began to murmur loudly regarding the odious war service of Spain. End quote. And it goes on with the back and forth, and the Romans keep plugging the dike and plugging the leaks, and let me pick up the text. The effect of such perfidy can well be imagined. As is invariably the case, it wrought far more harm than good to the perpetrators. A few years later, in 148, we jumped ahead about 50 years here, the wheel of Roman treachery turned full circle. A new governor, Gaius Vitellius, had surrounded a force of some 10,000 Lusitanian rebels. These were about ready to surrender when Viriathus, a minor guerrilla leader who had escaped the earlier Galba massacre, rose in assembly to remind the Lusitanians of Roman promises and Roman deeds, and then persuaded them to an escape attempt. Appian has left us a detailed account of this experience. Viriathus drew them all.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt here on this particular reading, but not only does it get a little boring, but all we're saying is that when you invade another man's turf, he's going to try to kill you or kill you. That's all there is to it. Story closed. Try to kill you any way he can, any way possible, any weapon he can use, any deceit he can use, any lie he can use, just like the Vietnamese in that war, or the Korean War, or any of them. Now the Middle East. When you go in there thinking they're going to greet you in the streets with flowers and waving your flag, the only reason they would do that is to deceive you and come back at night and kill you. That is, that's where it's at. And that's very simple. It's not complicated. We don't have to go on and read all this history about it. You invade and conquer or try to conquer another man's place, and he's going to use whatever means possible to kill you. This attitude that American politicians, that most of them never seen any kind of battle or anything, never even been in the military, with this idea, and even a lot of young troops that go overseas, they always expect it. We're liberating the people. We're going to bring democracy to them. That may sound pretty good right at the first when they're spending a lot of money in the bars and so forth, but when they soon realize that their country's infrastructure has been totally destroyed and Saddam Hussein looks pretty goddamn good now that the Iraqis look back on it and wish they had him back. I mean, you know, whose asshole are you going to follow? I'm going to follow the one that's not going to hurt me, not the one that's not going to blow my house up, the one that's not going to put radioactive surplus crap all over my country and like that. So all this is very simple, and we should boil it down. That's why I like Lone Wolf. We're straight out this way. We hate our enemies and we love our friends. And if my town's invaded, I'm going to kill somebody. And if my block is invaded, someone wanting to do bodily harm or steal everything I've got, they're going to die. Very simple. I have no interest, really, in going anyplace outside the borders of the United States. In fact, I don't think I'd fight for most of the Southwest. I mean, you say, oh, you got to fight for your country. Well, I've been all over this country, and there's a hell of a lot of this country that I don't think I want to fight for. Now, the people who live there, they're going to fight. That's good. But for me, I fight for where I'm at.
The chemtrails here over D.C. yesterday were just outrageous. It looked like tic-tac-toe in the sky. You know, when you were a kid and you'd be at the beach or you'd be at the stadium and the smoke rider came by and he'd be weaving around in the air and everybody would be looking up and he'd be writing messages in the sky like smoke Bull Durham and things like that, Pepsi. That's what the chemtrails look like. yesterday over D.C. It was absolutely, it looked like science fiction. And it's difficult to believe that people aren't phoning in and talking about it. Well, I know part of the answer to that is because they've got their faces in the screens. I'm going to read you an article from the January 28th issue of the Wall Street Journal, titled, Banks Prune More Branches. Bank branch closures in the U.S. last year hit the highest level on record so far, a sign that sweeping technological advances in mobile and electronic banking are paying off for lenders, but leaving some customers behind. U.S. banks cut a net 1,487 bank locations last year, according to Zozozo. Branch numbers have been on a steady decline since 2009 and reached a total of 96,339 at the middle of last year, the lowest since 2006, according to data from the FIDIC. That means that all those branches that were built between 06 and 09 went away, and we're back to 2006. Recent advances in mobile banking have accelerated the electronic trend. Some banks now allow customers to deposit checks simply by snapping photos of them with smartphones and sending them to their accounts. Bank of America Chief Brian Moynihan said that 9% of all checks deposited by customers in the fourth quarter came from snapping pictures on smartphones. That's huge. That means it's going to take over.